Hey, welcome back. Very pleased now to welcome another guest who has been with us several times in the past. And now she's got an exciting announcement for us. Jodelle Onstad is with us. And Jodelle, how are you?
I am wonderful. Thank you.
Last time we visited with you, you were busy working on the sort of final stages
yes.
of your book. And tell us about that.
Yes, we had lots of final stages coming into the home stretch. But we are finished, we are published, and we launch on May 24th. So
wow.
We're very excited.
Very excited. We're getting close.
We are.
And this has been a project of yours going on for years.
Yes, 15 years. I started in 2000, and I thought it was only going to take a few months because I didn't know it was going to get this in-depth. But as I studied, the more I studied, the more questions I had, and
give our listeners that maybe didn't hear some of our other conversations a little bit about your background
sure.
and the focus of your study.
Sure. The focus of my study was basically an investigative research. I call it the Sherlock Holmes approach as to whether or not God exists. I had come across research, academic research that really challenged my faith, challenged my beliefs. And I began researching for myself. Didn't want to rely.
You grew up as a.
Yes, I grew up as a Christian.
Okay.
Then
sort of strayed over the years.
Not really strayed, but more of, you know.
Questioned.
More questioned because there were some things that I had been raised that I learned could not be true. Simply because when it contradicts either something written in the text or, you know, when different sects have different beliefs, that really started bothering me. You know, Catholics have their beliefs, Baptists have their beliefs, Methodists. And we all think, okay, we serve God, we hold on to the truth, but. Yet,
how can you reconcile all this?
Exactly. So that really started to bother me. And I say in my book kind of that this idea that we've created many gods for ourselves, but we all attribute our gods to the one creator God. And so that becomes a real challenge to reconcile that. So the approach that I took was a very contextual approach. And what that means is that You read the text for what it says in context. You know, you don't just kind of, you know, snipe one verse here and one verse there. And I also did comparative studies, which means we go back to other ancient texts that have similar points of views or similar language to understand what the Hebrew text is saying. And my focus is really at this point the Hebrew text. My volume 2 will get into the New Testament. But at this point, I'm really just sticking with the Old Testament.
Okay. Well, is it going to be another 15 years
no,
for the New Testament?
No, believe it or not. The volume 2 is actually about 80% written.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I just have another. So we're hoping maybe I actually have 4 other books coming out between now and then. So
wow.
Just very, very busy.
So you're just writing up a storm here.
Yeah.
So this first book is the Old Testament is,
yes.
is your focus. And the book title is?
Yahweh Exists.
Yahweh Exists. So you've come to that conclusion. You're comfortable saying God does exist.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, it really took me a while because when you get into the documentary hypothesis, when you get into the archaeological research and you read the works of, say, Israel Finkelstein, you walk away saying, okay, Israel never existed as was recorded in scripture. It was just a bunch of folklore. And you really come away with a very inaccurate view of what the text records, but yet the scholarship that they present does provide a very valid challenge. So that what my job for myself and what the issues I had to resolve is how do the evidence that they have, the archaeological evidence, how does that reconcile with the scriptural text?
And the people that you're referring to are atheists?
Many of them are atheists, but you know, it's very, I hate to say it, but some of the people who do most damage to the text are indeed Christians. And granted, Jews as well, but they are believers. And the way that they do damage to the text is that they develop this theory, say for the date of the Exodus, and they start tossing out the scriptures that don't fit their theory and keeping the ones that do. So by not taking the entire mm-hmm. The entire story and all the evidence as a package deal and just kind of picking and choosing those texts that you're going to use, you end up in a totally different place than if you account for all the text and all the evidence and all the data.
So you've taken all of these arguments and you refute them in the book?
Yes, I do. We look at the validity of the scriptural text. We look at authorship. We look at archaeological evidence, both for the Exodus as well as the Canaan conquest, because the Canaan conquest is equally challenged, because right now in the 12th century, where it is currently and politically acceptable, there's not one shred of this massive scale conquest of the land that is referred to in the Hebrew text.
And through your investigations, you've concluded that the scripture is valid.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's valid, and it tells a very accurate story. But, you know, I have grown.
So it's not just mythology, not just legends, stories.
Believe it or not, no. Not that there aren't some great stories there. I mean, the story of Joseph is an incredible story, incredibly compelling and full of emotion. But it's based on real history. You know, there really was a Joseph. There really was a migration to Egypt. There really was an exodus out of Egypt, which is something that academia really does not embrace at this point in time.
Really? So academia believes that whole story, the Exodus, is just a story?
Folklore. Yeah, it really depends on which school of thought, because like the Germans are most notorious for the kind of this deconstruction of the text. And in their view, there is what was called a peasant revolt in the land of Canaan. That's one theory, where you had these oppressed slaves. They revolted against their masters, and they just somehow made up this story of Israel and the giving of a law at Sinai. And for no reason whatsoever, they created this folklore for themselves. Forget the fact that we have no parallels of this type of folklore occurring in any other ancient nation. It just somehow magically occurred in Israel. So the question that at some point I had to wrestle with was, which scenario is more believable, you know? So,
and how did you come to these determinations? How did you satisfy your own curiosity that you've discovered the truth here?
You know, it really came back to a lot of scholarship. I would go to, I didn't want to be biased in anything that I did, so I predominantly relied on atheist scholars, because if challenges or questions could withstand their arguments and could withstand their deconstruction of the text, then I figured that it was pretty safe to say that this is valid. So, like for covenants, I went to the predominant scholars on covenants, whether it's McCarthy or Mendenhall or whomever. I would work with those scholars, research and apply it to the scriptural text. And one thing that I did discover that's a little bit different than the traditional point of view is, you know, they have these 8 points of ancient scriptural text. And the Hebrew text, I discovered that there's one more, and that there's always a sign that you're in compliance with the text. And that's something that other scholars have not yet recognized in their work.
So you sort of did some groundbreaking research here.
I really think so. You know, I really hope that other people, what I've done is just kind of laid a foundation.
Right.
I really hope that others will take my work and run with it, explore it. Because all I could do in this amount of time was really scratch the surface.
And obviously, some of the issues you address, such as the date of the Exodus.
Yes.
What is the commonly held view, and what have you uncovered?
Sure. The commonly held view is around 1250 BCE, which was called the 13th century. Another group will date it around 1150 BCE. The problem with this date is that it leaves no time for the chronology of the Judges era. So what you end up doing is placing them and overlapping the Judges era one over the other, so that each judge ruled in a territory. And that really goes against Judges 2:16, where it states that one judge ruled, and then there was a time of oppression, and it gives this formula for how it should be interpreted. But the other issues is the fact that there's no archaeological evidence, there's no evidence of migration, there's no evidence of this. There was evidence of corvée labor, but not really to the extent that's mentioned in the Hebrew text. It was really just a continuity of the entire period. So there is no break, no evidence of the plagues. And as far as Pharaoh being drowned at the Red Sea, we still have Ramesses' mummy. So it's not very likely. So with my scenario, which does place it in the 16th century, the date of the Exodus that I present is...
So 300 years earlier.
Yes. Yes, 1548.
Wow.
And what's very interesting is that if you go back to the turn of the century, you know, the early Christian era, every single Christian author and every single Jewish author had a date for the Exodus that they embraced. And it just so happens to be the exact same date that I embrace.
But over time, it became less popular.
Well, partly over time, but, you know, it really kind of changed when excavations of the Holy Land, Albright started excavating, and he saw this massive wave of destruction, and he believed that to be the Canaan conquest. What we've now learned is that it's so much later, but the paradigms haven't shifted. They haven't adjusted to that, mainly because the people that are still working and digging at these sites are the students of these pioneers in their field, and they're still, you know, holding to this paradigm that was established.
So, Jadel, if listeners out there hear, well, you know, 1548 BC or 1248 BC, what does it matter as long as it's true, as long as it did occur?
Right, right. And then that's one valid argument is that, you know, the dates don't really matter as long as it occurred. For those of us that have curious minds and those of us that question, you know, questions and we have answers, you know, we want something solid. We some of us have seen that, you know, like Santa Claus, you know, it's a good fairy tale. It makes us feel really good. But when you grow up and
you learn something different.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, it comes along just the quest for truth and validity.
All right, Jadel, hang on. We're going to take a brief time out. We'll come back with more. Yahweh Exists is the book. It's coming out May 24th.
Yes. And it is on Amazon.
And we'll give more details. Any local bookstores?
Not yet, but we are working on that.
All right, hang on. We'll take a brief time out to take care of some business. It's Ringside right here on WGSO. Welcome back. Jadel Onstad is with us. The book is Yahweh Exists. It's going to be released on May 24th. You can get it on Amazon and hopefully some local bookstores as well. And I want to talk a little bit about the information that you've given me here about a controversial topic. Tell us about the difference between the Ark of the Covenant and the Ark of the Testimony.
Sure. It's in the Hebrew text, you find that at Mount Sinai, God commands Moses to create this ark to hold the nation's constitution, which would have been the Ark of the Covenant, the actual written covenant between God and the nation of Israel. Right. It included the Ten Commandments, but it was more than that. It had the Ten Commandments were the stipulations, but beyond that, you had like stipulations for deposit, the fact that it had to be in a temple, which was very common. Most covenants, that was the stipulation. You also had that it was to be read periodically during the year. But beyond that, you had penalties for it. So, you know, you had penalties for breach of pact. So the testimony, in my research, what I discovered is that the testimony refers specifically to the curses portion of the covenant. And the reason that this becomes important is that when you follow the curses and you take them in a very chronological manner, you find that it produces a chronological law for all prophecy. So they would have followed this, all prophets would have adhered to it, and in a way it becomes sort of a Bible code. Mm-hmm. But it's not a hidden Bible code, it's something that's very plainly given to you and very plainly laid out in God's judgments against you if you violate it. One of the definitions of the word testimony, I believe it's eduth, and one of the definitions of that word is the fact that it testifies against you or for you. So there's this idea that if you are if you have these curses in your life or let's say even in your nation, that means that you have violated these particular aspects of the covenant, and that's why you're seeing those manifest. So it's the idea that the curses themselves even testify against you, or if you don't have those curses, then the blessings of it testify for you.
Now, you say this topic is controversial because it challenges a lot of the Bible code ideas.
It does. You know, when through my research, I worked with some of the Bible codes, and what I discovered is that each group, each sect, kind of has their own Bible codes. So that for this group, you know, say a Messianic group, these codes mean this. For a Kabbalah, Jewish Kabbalah group, these codes mean this. So it means different things because your input data is different. So you can really extract something different from it. With this, I find it's just very straightforward. You know, in Deuteronomy 30:14, it states that the commandment, the law that God has given to Israel is not hidden. He says it's very easy. It's very close to you. So you don't find the idea that that following scripture, the idea that following this constitution that God gave to ancient Israel, you don't find that it's something that's very mystical.
So you don't need a code.
No, you really don't. Mm-hmm. You really don't. The code that I present, and I use the word code very loosely because all that it really is a chronology of God's judgments against Israel. But it's very plainly laid out in Deuteronomy 28, Deuteronomy 29, Deuteronomy 30. So it's very plainly laid out. Mm-hmm. It's right there in black and white, and it really is not hidden.
Now, the Ark of the Covenant itself, we've seen it in movies, we've seen it in TV specials. I saw a show about it recently where, you know, all kinds of people are hunting for it.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about it?
I'm still waiting for Indiana Jones to find it.
Right.
Yeah, no, you know, I don't know where it is. I've traced some of the various...
Do you believe that it exists somewhere?
I believe, you know, I would
like... Or was it destroyed?
I would like to believe that it exists somewhere. I'll say that because...
At one time, there's no doubt. I mean, it did exist.
And there is evidence that Jeremiah, and this is one of the views, that Jeremiah, when he migrated to Egypt for a short time, that company of people took it south into Egypt, whether it ended up at Elephantine or Aswan. I mean, there's lots of different theories out there. Those are possible. Other theories are that it's still buried way in a secret chamber beneath the Temple Mount. You know,
I've heard it could be in Ethiopia.
Yes, yes. So, you know, there's just all these theories, and right now that's what they are, theories, until we actually, you know, get
hands
on it.
So you have no real idea where it could be? Or
no,
right.
I haven't. And, you know, I really haven't seen that much credible research,
right,
simply because when you go into scholarship, you have to have some sort of evidence to go on. And other than some written texts, you know, ancient Jewish texts, ancient Christian texts, and what can be kind of inferred in the scriptural text, we really don't have that much to go on.
Jodel, there seems to be a resurgence of interest in the Old Testament and the New Testament, in the Bible, in many of these both historical and religious incidents that have occurred in ancient times. Do you think there's some sort of a spiritual reawakening going on?
Absolutely. I really do. I cannot tell you on social media how many people I run into that are searching and they feel like they're finding, you know, credible evidence. And a lot of it is, you know, we went through this period of time where Christianity and Judaism and religion in general was just so demonized by the political left. You know, any belief in God, you know, you're a fanatic. And, you know, I think comes a time where we have to reclaim that and say, no, this is valid. This is logical. And, you know, this is a way for society.
And was that what motivated you?
It really was. What motivated me to present a study for everyone else is I figured there were other people out there struggling with the same issues I had struggled with.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, there's no way that people are going to have time to do this research.
And you did it.
Yes.
And you've laid it out. And how many pages is
okay.
your book?
Now, are you wanting the final? Okay. And I did bring in a reader's copy. This is called the Galley Proofs. I brought this into the studio this morning.
Okay.
So if you want to just go by the, including the indices, we stop at about 1,136 pages. But as far as the actual text, including the appendices, we're like right around 900 pages.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you must feel proud of this work.
I do. You know, I feel good in, you know, what I've done and the research I presented. But, you know, even more than that, I would like to see it benefit other people.
All right. And we certainly believe it will. Jodel, thank you so much for being with us. And we'll put information on the podcast page about how people can order Yahweh Exists. Thanks to all our guests today. Congratulations to our Blue Bayou winners. We'll have more ticket giveaways throughout.